Unlike Frost, Kipling, and Yeats, this stuff is corny, humdrum, and terse. So apologies to all the poetic greats for opening each week with so-called verse. Oh yeah, welcome to Spectrum West, everybody. I'm Al Ross. Segments on this week's show are an assortment to be sure. We're going to talk about an event designed for shining the spotlight on human trafficking, as it's cultivated right under our noses. Our guests, Kat Jacoby and John Pulley, are with Fierce Freedom, an area nonprofit that educates on the plight, the warning signs, and what to do when they're noticed. Then we'll flip that coin in a way as Catherine Thomas talks with Christina Ward, the editor of a book about a woman of Wisconsin's past who literally dealt, at times, in the business of trafficking. Her name was Helen Cromwell, known as Dirty Helen Cromwell. She did her thing in Superior and Milwaukee, among other locations. Then we're going to downshift our gears and settle into an impromptu conversation recorded a couple Saturdays ago with jazz artist David Whitman while he was in town accepting an alumni award as part of the winter graduation process at UW-Eau Claire. The chat is being edited into two installments, the first this week, the second next week. And hey, let's kick off our show with the Eau Claire Improv Festival, shall we? It's next Saturday, the 18th, and my, how time flies. It's already a strapping 7 years old. Eau Claire Memorial High School mentor and stage veteran Amber Dernbach got it started and still steers it down the road. And a former student, now music director at the Second City in Chicago, Jacob Shuda, is bringing a special feature this year. I got to spend some quality time with him just the other day. So Amber, because we need to refresh people every time we have a guest in. They don't and I don't remember everything that we've talked about. You teach at Memorial High School and you're comfortable on stage as well.
Oh, sure. It's something that I've just always been drawn to, and both improvisational acting and acting with a script. And I do especially love comedy. And it wasn't until after I'd been performing in some jobs and touring companies, et cetera, that I decided that I'd go get my teaching license. And that's when I started ultimately working at Memorial.
What's your official curriculum? What do you teach at Memorial?
I have the best possible job ever. Oh. I love what I do. I have three different performance classes that I teach in the morning for students who are enrolled in special education. Those classes are called fine arts. It's a lot of creative movement.
Oh, wow.
We do improvisation, dance, and music. And then I teach classes called acting, class in directing.
Sure.
I teach a class in documentary theater. When you came to see our production,
they didn't have that
Traffic
in high school when I went to high school.
That was a class that I developed because that's another kind of niche interest area of mine outside of comedy is documentary theater.
We took like civics, and we had stupid gym uniforms.
As students at Memorial are lucky. There's a lot of different performance-based classes
that's
that are offered.
And you are familiar with Jacob Shuda, aren't you?
We go way back.
Oh, how?
we've known each other at least 15 or 16 years now.
You're really aging me.
So if you go and read up on Jacob Shuda, you come across the words moon worshiper. What the hell does that mean?
I just like to throw a little bit of personality into my professional bio.
Okay.
And although I'm not a true witch or anything, I just love staring at the moon. I'm just a big fan of the moon. So me and my friends, anytime we see a beautiful moon in the sea. Also, you have to remember, in Chicago, you don't really have stars.
That's
when the moon
true.
Is out, you text your friend and say, go look at the moon, feeling of nature in the big concrete jungle.
Okay, so how glowing is your impression and memory of Amber Dernbach?
Bright. Very bright.
Kind of like the moon.
Exactly. Amber is the moon of my early art career.
The full moon. Let's say full while we're at it.
But truly, like you said, our high school experience was full of the arts. And I credit Amber with a lot of the direction and mentorship that really inspired me to go into it professionally and take that risk. Still, you know, I've taken improv classes and worked in comedy and theater for a long time now, and Amber's approach to improv and theater of the heart is still one of my favorite ones that I remember and try and emulate myself.
Interesting that you use the word risk, because that's what improv's all about, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
This live scoring of improv, I see that you started doing that at age 16. Tell me about live scoring improv.
Well, live scoring improv is just my fancy way of saying playing along as a musician to the action on stage. I think it's so important. Sometimes in my work at Second City, we've referred to the musical director as the cinematographer, because the music can really frame the context of what's happening. I actually was just talking with an old-timer who was on the first ETC show in 1983, and we were talking about Fred Kaz, who was the main stage musical director for decades at Second City, mm-hmm. and how he could play your walk on the piano. You know, when you walked across stage, he could just play exactly what you were embodying musically. That is something I enjoy greatly, whether it's professional or just for fun. Play music and improvise music along with the action and keep up with every moment and support each moment of drama or comedy to the best of my ability can really heighten it. Improv is obviously a bare bones art form. You have people and you have an agreement between the two actors. That's really what's making it work. And so a little light support or music support, it's another element that can help it grow and be even more exciting.
Mm-hmm. I urge you to be careful in the usage of terms like old timer when you're talking to a guy like me on the radio. Okay. Okay. So just wanted to get that out there. So, you know, all right. So, now, one of the big features of the Eau Claire Improv Festival on Saturday, January 18th, is something called Immediate Musical. That sounds like improv taken to a new level. Talk about that.
So Immediate Musical is a completely improvised narrative musical. It has a plot throughout. Sometimes you're improvising in what we call a montage, where you're just doing various scenes, and they might have some connection, but it's not the main purpose. In Immediate Musical, I on the piano and my actors are improvising a full plot and staging of a musical over the course of 30 minutes to an hour, depending on what the show is.
Wow.
Part of the magic of the show is that as things unfold, it can be truly mind-blowing when you know they're improvising, they're taking suggestions, they're making moves in the moment, and yet somehow they can still create a story that has an ending, that does agree on where the action is going. And it takes a lot of coordination. It takes very smart players who can improvise, think about structure on their feet, and sing. And putting all those things together is one of my all-time favorite things to do.
And think about it. Doesn't this stand the possibility you could have a gangbuster regular musical on your hands?
You know, I haven't thought about it that way. So yeah, it could be a great creation device as well. You know, you often want to write without editing, and that's improv in a lot of ways. You're letting the idea live before you shoot it down. You're exploring it all the way before you say, you know what, that's not the idea.
You could come up with a whole new fresh, because that seems to be the theme with musicals nowadays, is fresh. And you could do that, so way to go. That's Jacob Shuda. He's one of the guests at the 7th Annual Eau Claire Improv Festival. It's coming up Saturday, January 18th at the Metro in downtown Eau Claire. Also in the studio is Amber Dernbach. What should I call you? Are you a coordinator? Are you a founder? Whole improv festival your idea?
Yeah, it was.
Why don't we call it Amber's Improv Festival?
it originated as a way to not only celebrate what was happening with our program at Memorial, but a way to bring graduates back. So yeah, that was the initial impetus. And since then, I've had a lot of supporters along the way. So my husband, John Olstead, directs it with me now, and he handles a lot of the business end. And then there's been key players that are part of our board. We're now actually, Eau Claire Improv Institute is an official nonprofit, and we want to do whatever we can to heighten that experience in the Chippewa Valley.
Good for you. I'm trying to imagine all this stuff, not only the Immediate Musical with Jacob's group, and I should point out that Jacob is with the Second City out of the Chicago area. You have local groups, Memorial High School Improv. You have Minneapolis-based, it says here, Glassworks. I saw Eau Claire people. I went online and watched. Are they Minneapolis-based?
They live in Minneapolis now, but yes. And you've had some
of
them. Yep. I think actually one of the first improv festivals, Mac Hastings and I were here in the studio together.
Yes.
Mac and Elliot. And they are also Memorial grads.
Cool. So they're there. And then Shambles. What is Shambles?
Yeah. Shambles is a group that I've been playing with in some iteration or another for the last 7 years. our members are primarily based in the Chippewa Valley.
So, Jacob, I need to congratulate you on your tenure. That's quite a gig you have. Did you have goals as a young guy, and was this kind of thing one of them?
I've always wanted to be a working musician, and I also think it's important to have goals and dreams, but keep them slightly vague. My goal, I moved down to Chicago just to explore the long-form improv scene, not with the intention of staying in the city forever or even with the intention of working at the Second City, where I never actually went to the Second City in my first 2.5 years in Chicago before they emailed me to come audition for them, because I was focused mainly on long-form improv, on stuff in storefront theaters or the Playground, which is a improv collective, or a Improv Olympic IO theater where long-form is taught in here in Chicago. And I can't say I ever thought I would have a job as a musical director at the Second City for 10 years, or even thought that was a possibility. It wasn't quite on my radar. I started scoring improv in high school with Amber's, so I started doing that for money and for fun around town, and then got noticed by the Second City, because it is a very specific skill set that I was just lucky enough to fall into.
And it's still fun.
That it is. You know, on main stage, you do 400 shows a year, and the audience often asks me how I'm still laughing. It's not because I'm an audience member seeing the show 400 times a year. It's a lot more fun to be doing the show.
Sure.
That's where the fun is. That's a performer mindset, of course, but I'd almost always rather be performing than watching.
Back to Amber. It appears that Eau Claire Improv Fest is going the way of many other things that have the two words Eau Claire either in front of them or behind them. So it appears to be growing. What are you imagining as a next step? Is it where you want it to be?
It's exactly where I'd like it to be right now. It's really important to me that as the festival grows, that we keep the local roots, continue to feature local performers in addition to whoever we're bringing from out of town, and that there's a really healthy balance.
It's another healthy thing that continues to put Eau Claire on the map. How do we get to be in the crowd?
If you go to volume1tickets.org, put in EC Improv Fest, you will get a ticket in advance for $25. They're $35 at the door. It's a lot less expensive than traveling to Chicago to see some of the talent that we're going to have here in town. The last time we did sell out. One of the things about the festival that is pretty amazing is that we do have such a loyal audience. There's a lot of people that have been there since the very first festival.
Thanks for coming in, Amber.
Thank you for having us.
And Jacob, wonderful talking to you again, and it'll be fun seeing you in Eau Claire.
Thanks for having me.
As usual, fun stuff. Human trafficking, David Whitman music, and more. Coming up on Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Support for WPR comes from the Great River Shakespeare Festival in Winona. This season features The Tempest, Great Expectations, and a new take on Taming of the Shrew. Season ticket information is at grsf.org. Getting a head start on that. Support also comes from Charter Bank, dedicated to investing in partnerships and offering Charter Bank business services with small business loans, treasury management services, and a variety of checking accounts. Details are at charterbank.bank. Here's a Spectrum memo for you. The Flambeau Valley Arts Association presents the Celtic Sound of Ring of Kerry Saturday. That's at the Ladysmith High School Auditorium. Have fun. Well, it was a coincidence, but on the same program in which we talk human trafficking, we have a conversation with the researcher and editor of a book about a notorious female figure of days gone by, Dirty Helen Cromwell. Catherine Thomas read the book and leads the discussion with Christina Ward.
Tell me about yourself. Who are you and why am I talking to you?
My name is Christina Ward, and I'm the vice president of Feral House Publishing. I'm a writer myself. We are an independent publisher, and one of our areas of focus is what we call lost stories of folks who have unique and interesting lives, the kind of lives that you might not think that your grandmothers led. We publish a number of books that have long been out of print with the cooperation of the family and any copyright holders to bring back those stories.
And today we're talking about a 2019 reissue of Good Time Party Girl, The Notorious Life of Dirty Helen Cromwell, 1886 to 1969. So who was Dirty Helen Cromwell and why does she fit into your publishing mission?
Dirty Helen Cromwell, first of all, her name came not from any hygiene issues, but because she was notorious with her swearing. She had a great gift for stringing together colorful curses, and that gave her the name Dirty Helen. Why she fit into our mission of bringing back stories, especially women's stories, was she published an autobiography of her life originally in 1966. And that life was not one that you would expect. She was an early sex worker. She was part of the Capone outfit. She very much made up the rules of her life and lived them on her own. And that includes starting businesses and starting legal businesses and illegal businesses. So I thought that was a really good fit to bring that story back to modern readers.
She starts out in Indiana and eventually she ends up in Milwaukee. On page one, it opens with a scene from 1927. Al Capone is a key figure in the scene. And he asks Helen, "Why does a girl of your background like this sort of life?" And Helen says it's because she's different. What did she mean by that?
Based on my research of, again, finding her family and talking to them, if you think about the time period, and we're talking about very early 1900s, a woman didn't have many rights as an individual woman. She couldn't have a bank account. She couldn't really own any property on her own as a single woman. As a widow, yes, but not as a single woman. She couldn't vote. There were very few avenues for a woman who did not want to lead a very traditional type of life. And so I think that's what Helen meant when she said she was different. From the onset, she felt a desire to get out and see the world and, again, live life on her terms and not on her husband's terms.
Her family was like a middle-class family. She didn't grow up poor. She actually had the opportunity to go to a university, which was uncommon for women at that time. But instead, she chose to go off to Cincinnati and with her first husband.
She talks about early on about, you know, having hot pants. And for that time period, for a woman to even acknowledge any type of sexual desire, again, was outside of the norm at all. And that's the reason she dropped out of college, was to follow her first love and essentially planned an escape from the train back to college to run off to Cincinnati to marry the fellow who became her first husband.
It sounds like, though, when she was younger, she was pretty innocent. There's a story about going to visit her cousin, and it's her first realization that people have sex lives and they talk about them. She was shocked that her cousin could talk about those kinds of things so openly.
Absolutely. It was a very an enlightening trip for her, where those were topics that you didn't talk about. And then traveling with a cousin who was just a year or two older, she had her eyes opened of like, oh, what she was feeling, what she was thinking wasn't abnormal. There was nothing wrong with her.
But eventually Helen does get into the sex industry. How does that happen?
It becomes an expression of kind of rage against her husband, who, as was common at the time for men, who it was no big deal for him to have an affair. And Helen asked him to stop, and he didn't. And so she finally embraced her anger, and they broke up, and she chose a very flamboyant way to do it. And part of that was essentially going on paid dates.
Yes, indeed. Besides her illegal work, she did have quite a few legitimate jobs, mostly in clothing sales. What do you think Helen's life story tells us about women and the economy in the 20th century? She wondered if her work outside the home was selfish and if it had contributed to the failure of her first marriage.
And isn't it an interesting observation, because women today are still being culturally fed that idea, either the extreme of you must stay at home and devote yourself to your family, or you must devote yourself to a career, or that third way of that very 1990s, you can do it all. I think what Helen's story tells us and shares is that idea that the struggle for identity, the struggle to become a modern woman, is one that women have been engaged in for at least, you know, the last 100 years, and that there's no one way. For Helen, she loved selling clothes, And she loved having access to the high life and having a good time. And she found a way to make that happen for herself.
There are a couple quotes from the book. When she's first getting into sex work, she says, "I liked being valued." And about one of her earliest clients, she says, "I exploited him to the fullest extent."
She did like that idea of being valued as a person. And maybe I think she didn't quite get that early on. In her stories, they're very raucous. They're very fun. And they're at times a little bittersweet with that hindsight of a life well lived and thinking about, well, maybe some of the choices I made weren't the best, but they were the best for her at that time. And I think that's where it's good to revisit some of these stories, because we get to have that really great firsthand, first-generation information about different choices that women made and are still forced to make today.
We're talking with Christina Ward of Farrell Publishing House to talk about the recent reissue of the book Good Time Party Girl, The Notorious Life of Dirty Helen Cromwell. She's joining us from WPR's Milwaukee studio. Helen is from Indiana. She spends time in other states and cities. Eventually, she ends up in Superior, Wisconsin. What brought her to Superior?
Al Capone. It may seem odd that he suggested she go start a brothel in Superior, but Superior was a huge mining and shipping town, and there was a lot of itinerant workers and transient folks, and so that was a good town for folks to come and party and to have those kind of illegal businesses set up around that. Not to mention, its access across Lake Superior meant that Superior was taking in a lot of illegal alcohol from Canada, and that's how she got her start, moving up from Chicago.
And then from there, she goes to Milwaukee.
She does. She plans like going back to Al Capone and kind of saying, what next? And she kind of detoured in Milwaukee based on having some conversations with folks. Milwaukee was considered essentially kind of a neutral town. Capone didn't run it, and neither did the Kansas City mob. They kind of had a detente. No one owned Milwaukee. And so that was a real safe place for her to go. So by Helen setting up as her kind of retirement as an older woman in her like early 50s, her speakeasy in Milwaukee, she became also a conduit for Capone to distribute alcohol to the millionaires and the industrialists of Milwaukee.
Helen opened a tavern in Milwaukee in the 1920s, and she called it the Sunflower Inn. And at this point in time, I think she had retired from sex work.
Yes, she ran the speakeasy, and in a brilliant business move, because she made the observation that most of the speakeasies were being kind of busted up in the evening. And so she ran hers near the Industrial Valley, Menominee Valley in Milwaukee, where all the factories were, and ran it as a daytime speakeasy. She made lots of money and didn't have too much fuss from the law enforcement.
She was good friends with the chief of police, I understand, who knew what she was up to and just gave her the advice, don't get caught. So she had friends in high places and low places.
She sure did. She only served two kinds of alcohol, bourbon and scotch. And if you ordered anything else, you're going to get an earful, and she would make a great pretense into throwing you out. And it became, in the 40s and 50s, the place to go. All from the nightclubs to, you know, the sailors down at Great Lakes Station, everybody wanted to go to Sunflower Inn, or as it became known as, Dirty Helen's. We had a launch party here in Milwaukee, and we were so happy and surprised that folks that actually knew Helen had went to the bar, and her hairdresser had come out to the party in their 90s and all spoke about actually what a kind and generous woman she was. Here was a woman entrepreneur who ran post-prohibition, a legal business for almost 40 years, and did it successfully. And until her health issues caught up with her, she had a really good run, and no one can deny that success.
What is your assessment of Helen?
I think I like her, honestly. No one is 100% black and white, good or bad. And I think when folks, if they get the opportunity to read the book, they'll like her too, because she is so very real and very human.
Why don't you tell us your favorite Dirty Helen story?
One of my favorite stories is, again, as I mentioned, she served only scotch and bourbon, and it was Old Fitzgerald, which was run by the Julian Seitzel family, and they're famous now for the Patty Van Winkle, some of the most sought-after bourbons in the world. During an annual party, they sent her an invitation to come down to Louisville, Kentucky, to go to the big anniversary party. And Helen left it to the last minute and then decided to go, hailed a cab, drove down to Louisville. They had a great time at the party, stayed overnight, ate breakfast, and then right back. Now, some of those stories, you're not quite sure if that's true or not. So I actually got a hold of Julian Seitzel. That absolutely happened. She did that. My grandfather always told us that story, too.
Wow. What a life she led. Very full, colorful. Christina Ward, thanks for your time today and for telling us more about Dirty Helen Cromwell.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a delight to talk about Helen.
Good story. You're listening to Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. What's the best way to separate a story of actual past exploitation from one about contemporary human trafficking? Put them back to back, I say. There's contrast there. Yes, human trafficking takes several insidious forms, and they're happening right under our noses. Speaking of noses, to thumb our noses at this affront to society simply because it isn't touching our personal space is to disregard something just beyond that space, always ready to affect our lives in some way. Saturday, Fierce Freedom, doing the job of educating us on the serious topic, presents Hidden in Plain Sight, debunking the myths of human trafficking in our community. Kat Jacoby and John Pulley are part of the implementation crew.
I think things since Fierce Freedom's inception have grown and evolved a bit. At our root, we work to educate and equip communities, individuals, and organizations to abolish human trafficking and modern-day slavery. Last year, you know, the final numbers were in, so we spoke to about 4,500 people so that we're able to have this conversation so that they can be equipped to know how to report it, what it looks like, and things like that. It began as Fierce Beauty, which was basically a fundraising effort of selling scarves. And that was actually to give the money to International Justice Mission. And then now it's basically really rooted in the domestic side of it because the Chippewa Valley is our home. So we really care about fighting it, you know, boots on the ground effort.
I'm going to define it for the audience. Human trafficking is a form of modern day slavery in which human beings are controlled and exploited for profit. Perpetrators use force, fraud, or coercion to manipulate and establish control over individuals. Now, you have this event, which is why you're here, and we want to help you promote it. The title has the words debunking the myths in it. So what are the myths of human trafficking where we live?
I think the biggest one is just that it doesn't happen here. I think people, you know, assume that it's those larger cities. It absolutely happens in Milwaukee and those bigger cities. Yeah. Milwaukee has been called the Harvard of pimp school. So we know it happens there. When I say Harvard of pimp school, I'm talking about traffickers are being trained how to manipulate and exploit because it's so profitable.
Wow.
It generates, it's estimated $9.8 billion every year in the U.S., sex trafficking alone. So we are talking about big cities, but we're also talking about what about those rural communities? In Eau Claire, we're a city of about 67,000 people, but we're also surrounded by rural area. And so human trafficking has been reported in every county, but it's going to look different no matter where you are. So I think the really big push behind this event is showing people that, yes, it happens in big cities, but it also happens here. Here's how to look for it. It's not always going to look like what you think it is. So with that, I think we are going to dispel some of those myths, and we're going to equip people to know exactly what to look for. And then maybe those wheels are going to kind of turn and they're going to think, okay, in the future, I can know exactly this is something that I want to report and this is something I want to give to local law enforcement.
How long ago was it that people in communities the size of Eau Claire, Wisconsin, just simply did not have to address human trafficking? Or has it always been around?
Well, I think that's one of the key things is it's been around for so long, but people didn't recognize it. I mean, that's why the title of it is Hidden in Plain Sight. Like for myself, I know that when I became educated on human trafficking and what it actually was, you know, the only thing I had experience with was watching the movie Taken. Liam Neeson with some kid that's abducted and taken overseas and sold. What I didn't realize is when you look at the definition of it using force, fraud, coercion, I mean, traffickers have done an amazing job through the years of normalizing what they do. For instance, I mean, prostitution has been called the oldest profession, right?
Yes.
The reality is, in many cases, it's not a profession. In many cases, it's people that have taken advantage of a vulnerable population that have weaknesses, that have vulnerabilities. They need money. They need food. They get them addicted to drugs, all for the sole purpose of being able to take them and sell them to other people to be able to make money. So in that way, when you start looking at prostitution, it is a big player in human trafficking in general, which has been around for as long as we can even remember.
It's always been around, but now we have the vocabulary to talk about it because I think that, unfortunately, a rule of thumb is that weakness will be exploited and power will... Power that is corrupted will be, what is that quote? It's like absolute power corrupts absolutely. And so I think when there's a weaker party, there is going to be power that exploits that. So that is human trafficking, that use of force, fraud, and coercion. And I think another thing I was thinking about when John was talking about that, one of the big myths is it is a choice, you know, because I think that even when we say the word child prostitute, that's sort of denoting a choice that they've chosen to go into this. If we're going off of the definition of human trafficking, it's anybody that's under the age of 18 should be considered a victim. They should not be considered someone that is making a choice. Many people assume, but they've chosen this. Like John mentioned, many of them are marginalized. Many of them are in situations where they're addicted to drugs. They're in a situation where they need to survive. They may turn to selling themselves. Somebody may come along and offer, you know, a place for them to stay for the night. And especially online. I mean, that is how it's virtually exploded. Kids are getting groomed online through apps and things like that, but from predators. That's how they sort of get in. And I think kids really think, I'm really safe behind this screen. They think that nothing could really touch them. But again, like that's how predators are able to really successfully groom victims a lot of times. And it's even just getting your foot in the door. I mean, a predator is going to get their foot in the door and they're going to make that initial contact with a child. Oftentimes, I say a child, but it can be anybody. They will start asking questions and gaining trust and finding out the weaknesses. And so even if you think you could not be affected and you kind of have that naivete, that's kind of one of the myths, I think, that we really want to expose.
Sure.
And we don't want parents to think, this wouldn't happen to my kid or this wouldn't happen to me. We want everybody to take a long inventory of what are their own vulnerabilities or the vulnerabilities of those that they love in their lives, too. Mm-hmm.
That's the voice of Kat Jacoby. She's PR and program coordinator. And also in the studio with us, John Pulley, Donor Relations. They're both involved with Fierce Freedom. That's a group putting on an event this Saturday called Hidden in Plain Sight, Debunking the Myths of Human Trafficking. In our community, it takes place Saturday, 1 to 5. It's at the Pablo Center. Let's talk about who's going to be there. You have guest speakers.
We do. Yes.
Emmy Myers, she's from Jackson, Wisconsin,
right.
Southeastern Wisconsin. Lacey's Hope Project, she's involved with, and Lisa McCormick from TOMA.
Mm-hmm. So Emmy Myers, she is herself a survivor, and she's going to talk a little bit about how she was groomed into trafficking. And so it's not like it's someone from, you know, a really big city outside of this area.
We can relate with
we
what
can
she
relate
says.
To that. And also, so Lisa McCormick, well, I have kind of a more of a personal connection with her. I was able to speak alongside her for a panel a couple months back at Rotary Club. And she'll share her story about her son and how he was tragically lost to trafficking. It's very real. And not only that, it happens to males and females. And so, again, it's debunking the myths. So it's going back to what's their perception and then changing that.
Here's the quote. Education is the number one way to prevent human trafficking. And your event is all about education.
Absolutely.
What is it like in society nowadays? You hear about people being reluctant to get involved. And I see this as, and maybe you use the same slogan as it relates to terrorism, see something, say something. Do you have the same sort of philosophy?
Oh, absolutely. That's the biggest reason that education has value. Once you take someone, like myself, given the example of I had no idea what to look for. I had no idea what it looked like. You may think that you're safe at home as a teenager playing Fortnite, when you're really getting talked to by somebody online, or whether you live in the suburbs. It doesn't matter where you are, you can get captured by this. So once they start to recognize signs at a hotel, at a truck stop, at Walmart, once they start to recognize it, then you can report it and allow the police the opportunity to get involved and help to rescue these folks that are vulnerable.
Okay, now in addition to things like this that you're putting on Saturday, are you a source? Are you a thing, a place that people who see something can come to? Do you suggest they go to law enforcement? Because you do have law enforcement and the Eau Claire City Manager being part of Saturday's event, so it probably is going to be up to them to say, here's what we think you should do.
I mean, I think it's kind of a twofold effort, because if you have questions about how to report, we're happy to answer those questions.
Okay.
However, we do think just getting that information straight to the source of Eau Claire Police Department, you know, we've worked with Lieutenant Ryan Dahlgren, who's going to be on our panel and speaking. He's really glad when people report to him, even if you give a tip that goes nowhere. But be as specific as possible, giving, you know, license plates, tattoos, things like that. But yeah, making sure that you know who to call, I think, is really key. But if you do have questions, we're here. We're here as a resource to the community.
Fierce Freedom is obviously a not-for-profit. And John, you're involved in donor relations. So how do people get involved in supporting Fierce Freedom going forward?
Well, there are a variety of ways you can do so. We've really kicked off in the last 6 months our monthly giving program. Go to our website, fiercefreedom.org, and click on donate. It's always nice to get large checks from folks in the community, but if you've got a ton of people that are giving $10 a month, $20 a month, that makes a big impact on being able to reach more people. And we've also got a number of opportunities when it comes to sponsorships. I enjoy talking about this with the people in the community. Let them know what we're doing. Let them see what we're doing. Give them the opportunity to understand where, when they donate to us, where their dollars are going. That makes a big difference for people.
Okay, so back to Kat. Tell us how we can go Saturday.
Sure.
How do we get tickets?
So you can visit, like I said, visit our Facebook page. We really try to update that with our current events. But you can also visit our website. There you can also request a speaker. We can organize that. Other things you can look at, or upcoming events should be on there as well. And you can visit fiercefreedom.org. But how you can get to this event, it's at the Pablo in the Jamp Theater. It'll be from 1 to 5. You can visit our Eventbrite page if you want to reserve tickets beforehand. They're $5 each. We want it to be very affordable for people to come.
Good for you.
And I really want to say, too, for anybody in the community, even if you're not from Eau Claire, but you're around this area who is not sure if they want to come, I think each person has a role to play in the fight against human trafficking. So I really hope that you'll come check it out.
Thank you guys for coming in.
Thank you, Al.
Thank you so much for having us.
Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. So nice of you to join us. Support for WPR comes from Art Z Gallery in Amory. In January, Art Z Gallery presents an annual show featuring works by gallery members and invited guest artists who interpret the theme, Beginnings. More is at artzgallery.org. Mr. David Whitman is a really good jazz drummer. From Menominee, now living in California, he's also versatile in all forms of percussion, a sought-after performer with a whole host of music ensembles, symphonies to backing popular icons and classic performances on both coasts, in between, and in recording studios. His latest album, Soul Flow, you're listening to a little bit of it in the background, was released officially in December. He visited Eau Claire late last month to receive a UW Eau Claire President's Alumni Award. While in town, I coaxed him into our studio and we shot the breeze about whatever came up. This is the first of a two-part conversation.
I got a degree in music and played in the jazz bands and the orchestra and took part in all the stuff in the local music scene, played in rock bands and played down at the Stone's Throw every Monday night. We had a steady gig down there.
Who's we?
5 years. Andrew Neasley,
okay.
Jason Kraft, myself.
Did you have a jazz group or did you have a rock group?
Jazz,
or what did you have?
Oh, okay. Jazz, yeah. We were all jazz students at the university.
Were you ever a rock percussionist?
I did play with The Who this fall. That was pretty fantastic.
No.
You didn't know that?
I did not know that. No.
Yeah, this fall was very busy. I played with The Who, played with Weird Al Yankovic, I played with Johnny Mathis.
Go. No kidding. How do you get asked to do those kind of gigs?
You know, I have I suppose in Southern California, south of L.A., I'm kind of the guy to play that kind of music that's not engaged full-time with a symphony that can do that kind of freelance work.
So do you do a lot of, because I know you as a jazz drummer.
I do a lot of union jobs and back up other artists and play with the symphony and things like that.
Do you play things like timpani?
Absolutely.
You do?
Yes. I'm a classically trained percussionist. I have a doctorate and a master's in classical percussion performance. And, you know, my jazz education is, you know, primarily on the streets, so to speak, or in the clubs. I've always been a passionate jazz musician. And I do differ from a lot of my colleagues and even senior colleagues in that regard. I do a lot of that timpani work, marimba, you know, mallets, mallet percussion, things like that.
What's it like to switch back and forth?
I certainly use my many years of training, 11 years of college under my belt, and 3 degrees. After I got my doctorate, I spent another 10 years practicing, and I still continue to practice every moment I can. And that's kind of how it is to switch back and forth. You know, you rely on all those skills that you build up over time. One week it's working on some four mallet classical marimba thing, and another week it might be a timpani multiple percussion thing, and then another week it might be some kind of a recording on drum set, and then or maybe it's a Broadway tour. But you kind of prepare as you go, I suppose.
Sure.
I think my favorite gig this fall was, if you can believe this, Al.
Okay.
A one-time only staged concert performance of Tommy with the original Broadway cast and the original orchestra with a few new members, myself included, and Peter Townsend also playing on that. I mean, that was an amazing thing. I used to hit the roads around here after school and listen to Pinball Wizard and stuff,
sure,
you know, bang ding 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 ding, you know, and so I was actually up on stage and I did have to fight back a tear, you know, at that moment, because it was a really honorable experience to take part in and a lot of fun to boot.
So how much preparation does doing something like that take?
Not as much as I'd love to give it, because I also teach full time. I teach at a charter school and I teach at San Diego State University. And so, you know, how much time it takes to prepare, sometimes I don't get very much at all. You know, a lot of times I seem to settle into a one show a week kind of a thing when things are busy. And a lot of times I'll get the music around Monday or Tuesday. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I'm looking at the instruments that are needed and pulling them from my warehouse space where they're stored, thinking about how they're going to be set up and the logistics. And then maybe on Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday, I might get a chance to do some playing and look at some notes. Maybe I won't. I definitely have to do a lot of reading.
So the Tommy thing, you were doing more of a...
I was playing percussion on that. Xylophone, vibraphone, timpani, two timpani, large gong, small gong, you know, an assortment of cymbals.
So you don't ever sit in
chimes.
Front of this big drum kit?
I do. I do have quite a rig. All of that stuff was in the space of maybe 4 feet by 6 feet. I do play a lot of drum set as well. You know, I've spent a lot of time pursuing my own work.
After graduation, you know, we started out, and boy, did we get off on a tangent. We were talking about UW-Eau Claire.
Yeah.
Now we're talking about you're doing Tommy.
Well,
so
you know, all that stuff
cool.
that I'm doing is stuff that UW-Eau Claire prepared me for. That's
yes.
what I did when I was here. I prepared music and, you know, Robert Baca, the way he ran that big band really helped to set the stage for preparing me to be a professional, learning professionalism and learning how to prepare and, you know, what's expected of you on the bandstand and in that kind of environment. All of that I learned here. So it was a strong foundation for excellence. And in fact, last night at the post-awards ceremony gathering at the joint,
good
Jason Kraft and Andrew Neasley and myself had quite the conversation about how we do notice around the nation when we play with people from Eau Claire, there is a depth of musicianship there that isn't assured, you know, everywhere else.
Does UW-Eau Claire and the jazz studies program here have a reputation? If you say that you got your start there, do people say, oh, yeah, I've met a few people there?
Yeah, if they know players and they know music and what's happening, then it's a name that they are familiar with and should be synonymous with quality.
Mm-hmm. When did you get out in California?
Went out to California when I was finished with my residency at the University of Southern Mississippi for my doctorate. I had all my coursework completed and just needed to finish my dissertation. And I had bounced around so much, I wanted it to be the last move. And so I picked sunny California.
Sure.
I was born in San Diego, and my family was from there.
Oh, okay.
And so I had, you know, that type of support network to move into.
I've heard that so often from people. It's kind of like New York or Los Angeles, maybe Chicago, but it's a case of follow the music, is it not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I bounced from, except when I followed the music, it didn't take me to New York. At first, I went to Kansas, you know. I was on a cruise ship and Kansas State University and then Mississippi. And for me, actually, San Diego, it was really the weather that drew me there. But I just needed a big urban area, you know, where okay. I could live and thrive and work in my field. And I knew that I was going to play a lot because I was bound and determined. You know, when I go play, I want everybody around me to just unquestionably know that that is the guy to have playing, you know, because they're just going to ice it every time. So okay. that's what I do.
Good.
So I knew that I would play and work a lot.
How long did it take for you to become that guy?
Well, I'm still working on being that guy every day. It's okay. an ongoing struggle. You know, it's like lifelong thing. And I tell my students about that, too. I feel like as a musician, you know, you're only as good as your last gig. Frankly, not entirely, but to some extent, there's truth there.
Mm-hmm.
And that really keeps a fire lit under me. And, you know, every time I go out and every time I have a new something coming up, I always approach it with a renewed vigor. I feel like I'm still aspiring to be that kind of musician that does that. Nonetheless, it's the message I send and want to send as I play and, you know, put mm-hmm. good art out there that audiences will enjoy, you know, anytime I perform.
The California jazz scene, kind of a happening place. How long does it take to become a member of that fraternity? And what is it like once you get there? I mean, obviously there's no,
you know,
there's no jazz welcome wagon lady.
Right at my initial response to that question is, you know, maybe I'm not the best person for that question. There's so many great jazz musicians that I think of
mm-hmm.
who are my heroes who, you know, I feel like that's a question more fitting for them. I've never felt like at any time I was all of a sudden in some kind of a club or, you know, I had made it or something like that, and I still don't feel that way.
Well, do you want to feel that way someday?
You know, I don't know. I don't think that it's something that exists, really.
Okay.
You know, I just think, you know, people are people, and we're all trying to make good music and work hard, and, you know, we work together and collaborate, and, you know, if we have the beautiful opportunity to work together and collaborate with a particular musician, you know, then that's a wonderful thing.
Sure.
And we try to expand our networks and work with musicians that we like to work with and then surround ourselves with sort of a bubble of successful collaborators.
Let's step back again because that's the part of the development of a consummate musician that fascinates me, the young David Whitman. I'm curious if you at all can remember, if you've left the nest and you're out there feeling your oats, you've gotten your degrees and you decide, yes, okay, I'm going out to California. Or maybe this happened before then. I'm curious about the first time you sat in a studio or someone called you up on stage, the first time that you ever sat in and said, wow, I can hold my own with these guys.
Yeah. That is quite a question. You know, I think there's part of me that never will feel that way, frankly, Al.
How about I can keep up with these
and
guys?
It depends on who you're playing with, I guess. But, you know, there was a time in my career where I learned, even if I wasn't, you know, maybe playing something just so,
yeah.
I did learn how to not play it in a way where I would be interrupting the music or getting in the way of other people's ability to express themselves musically as I played with them. And I feel like that was an important point in my career. And I don't know if there was a particular moment that marked that, but I'd say it was within the last 10 years or so. I think the lessons I learned from Robert Baca and Ron Keyser and Jeffrey Kroll and Nobuyoshi Yasuda and, you know, all the other teachers and Richard Mark Heidel, he's not here anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The lessons I learned from them, I think they set me up and pointed me in a good direction towards achieving that. Even though I didn't achieve it here, I feel like that's what I was learning. I was learning how to begin to become a professional and which direction to go and how to make good choices and how to be a learner that can get there and be reflective. Yeah. And, you know, Robert Baca was very humbling for me and remains so to this day. My interactions with him continue to be motivational and humbling. And he always seems to guide me in the right direction. saying just the right thing or getting inside my head in just the right way, but he always seems to motivate me to to achieve more. And I think when I left Eau Claire, I had that, and I never lost that, and I kept going with that, and it was reinforced at the other schools that I went to.
I think we need to come up with a little Bob Baca doll that people can take with them. And
as well, this conversation's being recorded, so
I'm thinking
we can discuss this more maybe.
Sure. I'm thinking as you said that, how many times musicians who have graduated from Eau Claire and Bob said, "You're good. Go out and do some good stuff." How many times these musicians are in sessions or on stage and they have imagined the little Bob Angel sitting on their shoulder.
There is that.
Going, you can do this.
Oh, man.
You can do it, man.
Yeah, except for me, it's not always you can do it. You can do it, man. There's some of that. Not that, I mean, but there's a lot of lessons, a lot of moments and things that he said. Yeah.
Chapter 1 of Al Yaks with David Whitman. Chapter 2 is coming up next week. Don't miss it.
The Eau Claire Children's Theater will present The Bridge to Terabithia Friday and Saturday in the Oxford Theater. Murder Medium Rare, the Children's Theater Murder Mystery Dinner Theater, will be presented Fridays and Saturdays, January the 17th and 18th, and the 24th and the 25th. Agatha Christie's A Murder is Announced, a Miss Marple mystery, will be presented by the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild through Sunday, and the following Thursday through Sunday in the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild has scheduled auditions for Barefoot in the Park at 7 p.m. Monday and Tuesday in the Grand Theater. And the Eau Claire Children's Theater has scheduled auditions for Schoolhouse Rock Live for 5:30 p.m. Sunday and Monday, and also auditions for Mary Poppins for 7 p.m. Sunday and Monday. Both are in the Oxford Theater. For Spectrum West, I'm Jim Oliver.
And that's a little bit of Shuffle Blues there for you. Thank you, Jim, by the way. Also from the Soul Flow album from Mr. David Whitman. Chapter 2 again coming up next week. Also next week, the man helping sculpt one Eau Claire art landscape, the Winter Dance Party, returns. And more on Spectrum West. Quickly, a couple of memos. The Northern Lake Center for the Arts in Amory opens the annual student art exhibit Friday. And on Saturday, it's an evening of original stories, poems, and essays, as published in the Northern Lakes publication Soundings. NorthernLakeCenter.org. The Scotty Miller Band, four pieces playing blues and R&B, hit the Wide Spot PAC in Stockholm. Saturday, it's their first visit to the venue. Chippewa Valley Sierra Club presents a noted Driftless Area performer, Terry Mesh, reading from the works of Aldo Leopold, Walt Whitman, and Elizabeth Clark Hardy. That's Wednesday, January 15th. Thanks to Dean, Kate, Catherine Thomas, Jim Oliver, and you guys out there. Keep in touch on Facebook and via email, spectrumwest@wpr.org. I'm Al Ross. Thanks. See you next week.